Only one church. It's the Church of Jesus Christ. In the chapter we've read, chapter 12 that we read, at the very beginning of this chapter, you can see in verse 1, these are the statutes and the rules you should be careful to do in the land. Moses is teaching God's people to keep the commandments. Keep the commandments. And I think particularly, as you've perhaps if you can remember the bits that we were reading, idolatry and other gods is a great concern. He's really, in this particular part of his sermon, focusing in on the importance of keeping the first and the second commandment, honoring God and God alone, not making idols. And then in verse 2, there's a kind of practical application of the commandments against idolatry and other gods. There's an injunction from verse 2 onwards to destroy all the places where the nations worship their gods and serve their gods. Now, if I was an archaeologist, which I'm not, these words would make me weep. Because archaeologists love all these ancient artifacts, don't they? These beautiful items handed down from different nations, different parts of the world, different parts of history. And this commandment to utterly remove and destroy them, I suppose an archaeologist would be pulling their hair out. Don't do that. Don't do that. You go to the museums today and you'll see they're packed with these sort of things, aren't they? We go and look at them and point our fingers and read the little bits and this was used for this and this was used for that. And many of those things are religious artifacts, aren't they? You see, a lot of religious artifacts are particularly treasured in all these museums, because they're often of the highest artistic quality and cultural significance and all the rest of it. People do have different ideas. Perhaps you've seen in the news, there's a group of Jehovah's Witnesses down in South America that went up onto that Mayan ziggurat. Do you see that in the news? One of these kind of, like a bit like a pyramid sort of thing, and there was an altar in there, 700-800-year-old altar in there, and they went and they smashed it to pieces. They were arrested, obviously, by the government. I think it was in Peru. They were arrested and so on. They said, well, it was unchristian. It was, now we're going to try and destroy these artifacts. And a lot of people have been international outcry to see people like ISIS going into Palmyra, this ancient Greek city, Greek-Roman city, blowing up a temple that was there dedicated to some ancient God going back, I don't know how long, but to the archaeologist, to the historian, these are priceless windows into the past and past cultures, and they just blew them up because they were dedicated, had been built to the honor of other gods. The Taliban did it, didn't they, in Afghanistan? Those great big Buddhas, those great big statues in Afghanistan, they just stuck some dynamite, just blew the things up. Yeah, Christians, you look at the New Testament, do you see much of that in the New Testament? You don't really, do you? You don't see. I think that there's only two destructive acts that I could summon to mind in the New Testament. One of them was Peter picking up a sword and cutting off the temple guard's ear, and Jesus was very quick to rebuke him for that. And the other time was, and I mentioned it this morning, when in Ephesus, many people were converted in Ephesus, and they brought their books of spells and occult studies and stuff, and they burnt them in the street. But apart from that, I can't think of a single destructive act recorded done by any Christian in the whole New Testament. Overturning the tables. Okay. Yeah, over in the air. Thank you. Yeah, definitely. That's helpful. But by comparison to what we're reading here, these are minor things, aren't they? They're minor things. What we're reading here is about the absolute destruction of temples and altars and statuary. Pretty significant. Now these cultures, the kind of cultures of the people who lived in these places, we might call it pagan cultures or animistic cultures, they thrive, don't they, on these objects, these amulets and artifacts and special places and groves and sacrifices and rituals and the passing of different the moon and the alignment of the sun and all this sort of stuff. It's the kind of bread and butter of that kind of religion. These special places. And out of that come all their customs and their practices and their distinct traditions and clothes and so on and so forth. And many people go around the world and they're fascinated by these things. They're interested, aren't they? They see the beautiful colors and the unique statues and they're interested and curious. It's quaint, it's exotic, it's fascinating, and people read books and write books about it and all the rest of it. But I think it's good to remember, and I think this passage underlines some of it to us, that to the people who are inside that system, the people for whom that is their life, these things are not just quaint. These are the traditions that bind their lives. They determine the course of their lives. And often these traditions are exceedingly demanding. Their gods can be very demanding, very exacting upon them. There's an occult side to a lot of this kind of religions as well. Dark things. And for the person, can be very, very controlling. People can be very controlled within these systems of belief. Now, if I said to you that as of next year, our neighboring country, Holland, is planning to legalize the slaughter of children, would you imagine that our relationship with Holland would change?
Yes.
Do you think there would be an outcry about that? Do you think people would be outraged? Do you think there'd be appeals to change those laws and the people who are determining to practice those kind of things? And if they refused to back down, and we stood here as their neighbors, and they were determined to do this, and then started to do it, do you think the people of this country would quietly stand by and say, well, that's okay, you carry on, each to their own, live and let live? I think people would be throwing their weight about, wouldn't they? This has got to stop. These are innocent people. These are children. What are you doing? It could go to war, couldn't it? I mean, if people refuse to back down, people might feel they had to step in and do something about it. Turn with verse 31 with me. Did you see it there in verse 31 as we were reading it? I'm not going to read it out because of sensitive ears. Sensitive little ears. You read it there? You read it there? You see what they do? See what they're doing on those altars? In those temples? In front of those shrines, in front of those statues, in obedience to their gods. Is that okay? It's absolutely repugnant, isn't it? It's absolutely repugnant. So, whatever cost there might be, something needed to be done. Something needed to change. I'm not saying that's the reason this invasion came about, but God wanted something better for that land than to live under those controls, under that way of life, that level of fear, that lack of compassion and mercy and care. The things you might call Christian values, do you see in any way, shape or form that practice to be an exemplary of Christian or the worship of God? Anything. And people do things in the name of God, don't they? We're living in a day when people are doing things in the name of God. They say, this is God. And you know, and I know, this is not God. This is not God's will. God does not command such and such and such and such. But that's what they honestly believed. They believed that God was telling them to do these things. And they were utterly wrong. Utterly wrong. And needed to be disabused of these ideas, and that, at least in part, was the justification for this invasion. To systematically uproot these practices from the land, to root out these things from the land until the whole country is empty of these things. There is no sight of them at all. It's gone. It's finished. It's past. You know what they're sacrificing? You see what the Israelites are sacrificing? They're bringing their vows and their offerings. They're doing the sort of things that you and I, we've had a barbecue this week. You know, you make some food, you slaughter an animal or something like that, and you cook it and you share it out and you have a meal together. That's pleasing to the Lord, isn't it? People getting together, having food together, sharing food together, being thankful to God. Not that. Not verse 31. That is not the will of God. That is not the will of God. Can you imagine with those occasions, the verse 31 occasions, are they going to be seasons of rejoicing? It's awful. It's awful. But you can see what the character of the worship of God, as he says, when you get to the temple, when you get to the place, you bring your sacrifice. What's the word that comes up? It comes up three times in this passage. And you shall rejoice. That's one of a land where people rejoice, where people are happy, where people are free. Not oppressed, not terrified, not terrorized in the name of God. But a land where people are free. People have joy. So, I read this and I say, this is an act of deliverance. This destruction that is being called for is an act of deliverance to save the world from the potential, you know, this land from the continuation of these horrendous practices. Truly horrendous practices. We do that today, don't we? If somebody's doing something horrendous, we get the police onto it, we get it stopped. If we think in another country, sometimes if people are pushing it too far, that happened in Germany the last century, it went too far. In the end, we had to go to war to put it to a stop. An act of deliverance. Now, as Christians, I really don't believe that this passage is telling us that we should go around smashing up pictures, by the way, or smashing up statues. I really don't think that's what we're being taught as Christians. What I think we're taught as Christians, we read it in Thessalonians, is that we should turn from idols to the living God. We do have to repent, don't we? We can't tolerate such things. We've got to turn away from them. Christians, when we do ministry, when we do evangelism, people are caught up in these things. We are calling people to repent from them. We are asking people to change their lifestyle and give up practices. And they might be precious traditions. It might be a precious way of life to them, all they've known. And it might seem a big cost to clear their house of all of that stuff and start again with a whole new life. But that is turning from idols. It's part of our evangelism. Because verse 4 makes it very clear, speaking to God, this is not how you'll worship the Lord. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. That's not how it's done. There is a way to worship God, and there's a way not to worship him. I'd love to think, you know, we hear it so many times, do all ways lead to God, all roads lead to God, and all this sort of stuff, you know? No, there is a way to worship the Lord. And there are ways that are wrong. If there is a God and he is to be worshipped, surely you must worship him the way that pleases him. You can't make up how you want to please him and just say, well, you know, enjoy, you know, have that. That's what I want to give you. You've got to know what he wants. If you want to please him, you've got to give him what he wants. Do it his way. For many, many centuries, one of the practices that has taken place in the Western Church is what I want to call syncretism. There's another ism. You see, I went to theological seminary. That's my second one. This morning it was universalism. This evening it's syncretism. Okay, it's another ism I picked up while I was at theological seminary. And basically it's this. It's like you don't really change the substance of a thing. You just change the surface of it. It's like rebranding. You kind of take something and then you rebrand it. You give it another name, another And for many, many centuries, this is basically one of the practices in the Western church. So you go along to a sacred shrine. That was a sacred shrine to the people who lived there. You go and do evangelism, and you turn that shrine into a church. You say, well, I'm going to take that thing which was there before. It was precious to the people and important to them. We're not going to destroy it and get rid of it. We're just going to kind of baptize it, as it were, and make it useful to our ends and to our purposes. And honestly, when you look around at where churches are built and cathedrals, oftentimes they are connected, aren't they, to the religions that preceded them and the ways of life that went on before that. Now, if it's just to do with buildings, that's not just that big a deal, but also extends to holidays and the practice of certain times of the year and all the rest of it. All those things are kind of baptized and Christianized and all the rest of it. Think just of what's happened in Catholicism. So you've got Jesus, and then you've got Mary, and you've got Peter, and you've got kind of the apostles, and then you've got various saints and patron saints and saints for traveling and saints for this and saints for shoemaking. And what does that sound like a little bit to you? Does that sound a little bit like the old pagan pantheon of gods? You've got Zeus, and then you've got, we haven't got a woman one, so let's get Mary in there to fill in where Athena was or something like that. And then we used to, if you were going on a journey in the pagan, you'd have to go to the shrine of the god of journeys, and now you go to St. Christopher. You've got your little St. Christopher, and they've just taken the whole pagan pantheon and kind of Christianized the thing. You know, people pray not to God in the name of Jesus. People pray to these saints, and it's called the intercession of saints. You pray to Christopher and you say, Christopher, look, I'm going on this journey. Could you have a word with Jesus, because you're in heaven with him right now, and ask him whether you'd give me a safe journey? Forgive me if I sound like I'm running down other people's beliefs, but I'm just trying to expose this syncretism where there hasn't been a fundamental severing with the past, but a kind of building on it in some sort of shape or way. That's not what we're reading about here. We're not talking about replacing this statue with that statue. We're talking about knocking the whole thing down and having a whole clean slate. The language here: tear down, destroy, uproot, remove, cut down. There's no archives to be kept, no museums to be opened, no archaeological sites to be preserved. When Jesus talks about sweeping a house clean, do you know those things? You know, the man, his whole house was just clean house, cleaning it out, getting rid of the whole thing, like the Passover. There'd be no yeast in the house or in the bread at all. The aim is to present the whole land clean, a clean land. And that God's people, when we've turned from idols, we should be clean. We should be vessels fit for the Father's use. Those practices, those ways should not be found in us. It's a new life dedicated to one holy God who has, as we're seeing through this passage, one holy temple, one place where he calls us all to direct our hearts and our worship. So, there is a building up to be done. And there's something in this passage here about that building. There is a place where he'll appoint, a place where he's going to build, a place where he will set his name, a temple, a place where he will set his name. He doesn't, in the land, the worship of God is not going to be like picture stuck up in the attic with lots of other things. It's all cluttered in there. You can't see which is the picture and what is an old hat and what's the Christmas decorations all mixed in there like a... It's very clear. The temple's right there in the center of the land. You can't mistake it. There is nothing else. There is no other religion. There is just one. There's only one God, and that's where we worship him. Very open faith. You know that when Jesus talks about that your light should be like a city built on a hill, seen from afar. No clutter all around. I can't really see the temple because I've got all these other temples. No, it's just a plain, clear view. A plain and clear view. The focal point. And the God that we serve is not just to be the God of Israel, of a bit little patch of land, and that this is his land and everywhere else belongs to all the other gods. This is the God of the whole earth, But this is where he chooses to put his name. And that's what Christians are supposed to be, isn't it? We are the temple of the Lord. We're God's people. We're the temple of the Lord. People should see us not as like he is our God. He is God, and we are his temple. We are his witness. And it should be a clear view, not cluttered out with all these other practices and things that are not confuse the issue. And some of these practices are just downright evil. Such things are just not compatible with Christianity at all. Not at all. One faith, one Lord, one baptism, one hope, one spirit, one church, and that church is glorious. You know the temple they're going to build? You know, if you've ever read the description of the temple that they ended up building in the land? It was truly beautiful. Many people at the who witnessed it said it was one of the wonders of the world. It was absolutely beautiful. Not vulgar, beautiful. The Lord is beautiful. It's reflecting something of him, isn't it? It's reflecting something of him. In verse 8, Moses talks about how at the present time everybody's doing what is right in their own eyes. But as we go through to verse 13, you can see that what he's referring to is that it's this one place. At the moment, we're moving around. We go from here to there. But there's a time coming where all our eyes or all our attention is going to be focused on one place. It's going to be so clear where the Lord is. And all eyes will be focused on him. So, Moses is teaching them, we're not actually doing it right yet. There's still a way to go. We've got to keep reforming. We've got to keep changing. We've got to get rid of things. We've got to build things in place until our lives are focused on God and everybody can see. Now, I'm not going to go into too much, but you know that Jesus is our temple now, isn't he? Jesus is our temple. He's the place where the Lord has set his name. And it's from amongst the tribes, it says here, and in the land. And Jesus came from amongst the tribes, and he came in the land. It's Jesus we look to now, isn't it? And every Christian should be looking to him. Looking to him and him only. That's how you know somebody's a Christian, isn't it? They are focusing on Christ. So, I've got two other very brief points to follow on after that. That's my main point. This passage speaks of the single and concentrated devotion to God that is the direction of travel for his people. And this issue of joy, let me just pick up on that very, very briefly. Look at this there in verse 7. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice. You get there in verse 12 again. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God. And it's there in verse 18 too. You shall eat them before the Lord your God in the place that the Lord your God will choose. You and your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your Levite, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God in all that you undertake. Cleansed away from all that darkness banished from your life, and just enjoying God and the good things that he gives you with the people that he has given. You know, this is not a commandment. Sometimes, you know, I've heard in some ministry situations, somebody said, you know, the Bible says you've got to rejoice. And the pastor will say to the congregation, right, rejoice. And they'll, somebody will sit there, carry on sitting there, and say, come on, rejoice. And they'll kind of push them and bully them and tell they're rejoicing and stuff like that. You know, rejoicing is not, yeah, of course you can get a kind of a outward manifestation of partying of some sort. But this is not a command. He's not commanding people to rejoice. He's promising them when they get there and do this, they will be full of joy. It will be a joy with the good things that God has given in a clear space. So much in the Bible about joy, isn't there? Rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say rejoice. What? Rejoice in the Lord. When you consider him, when you look to the temple, when you look to Jesus Christ, when you bring your life to him, when you share the good things in his name. There's a joy in that. The joy of the Lord is my strength. I was thinking, everybody's different. Everybody's got different personalities. And some people are just more naturally joyful people. You know, you meet people, they're just very light-hearted, easygoing, happy sorts. Do you know what I mean? There are different personality types, aren't there? And I think on a scale, on the kind of that kind of personality scale, if I was thinking about myself, I don't think of myself as the particularly like a super happy kind of light-hearted type, particularly. You're kind of somewhere down number four or thereabouts. And I sometimes get quite concerned, you know, because joy is one of the characters of the Christian life, isn't it? It's one of the fruits of the Spirit. And I sometimes think, you know, oh, I'm being a bit serious. You know, I'm a bit serious. Where's the joy? But, you know, when I'm away from things and I'm quiet, even in the midst of it all, and I've got some time and I'm thinking, and I can just sense, it's like you open a little door and in there's this roaring fire of the joy of the Lord. And I've sort of shut the door again, you know, sort of thing, you know, but it's there, burning away. Jesus is wonderful. He's wonderful. And it is a joy to know him. It is a joy to be his disciple and follower and servant. It really is an absolute joy. Jesus fills my heart with joy. And I know I don't walk around sort of grinning like a Cheshire cat all the time. But it's there. It's there. The joy of the Lord. And I'm as confused as the rest of you half the time about what's going on in the world. You know, and even in life, just in our own lives, it's so much, it's all like a movable, the stuff going on all the time. And it can put a strain on you, can't you? It can be heavy and a bit oppressive and a bit heavy going and all the rest of it. But when you stop and you think, I just don't know it all, I do know the one who does know it all. I know him. That's amazing, isn't it? I know the one who knows. That fills me with joy. It restores my joy. And when it all seems very good, it almost seems outrageously arrogant to say, but it's true. I understand what life is about. I'm not claiming this for myself as if I'm the only person. I think the Bible reveals to anybody who'll listen and learn what life is all, what this thing is all about. You can know the meaning of life. That's amazing, isn't it? I'm not scratching my head about what the meaning of life is. I know what the meaning of life is. I know what the purpose of my life is. That produces an extraordinary joy. So, if the first point was to say that one church concentrated and devoted to God, that church then should know that the worship of God is a thing of joy. Joy is part of our worship. And very, very briefly and lastly, there's this couple of references in this passage to people who are not really the focus of this passage at all, but get various mentions along the way. People who are dedicated to the maintenance of this temple and to the service of this temple, people who are there to sort of promote this joy and facilitate this joy and this unity. These people mentioned there as in verse 12 as the Levites, these people who God has, haven't got a part in the world, they're just part of the temple in a way. People come and go and bring their sacrifices, enjoy worship and all these sort of things, and there are these people then helping to make sure it all happens. And Moses reminds the people of verse 12 not to forget about them, not to forget about these people who often have given up and the Lord is their portion. That's there in verse 19 as you go down into verse 19, the importance of recognizing and supporting people like that. Maybe there's people in your life who you know point you to Jesus and people who encourage you to serve the Lord, who are quietly serving you in such a way so that you can make progress in your faith. It says here, don't forget people like that. They're not there to control you. Leaders, spiritual leaders, people who are spiritual influence in your life, are not there to control you and to micromanage your life. That's not what we see here. You know, there's a whole passage, the whole section here about people eating your food in your own gates. There's something called privacy. That's right, isn't it? People should have privacy. You get into a church where they're invading your privacy to the point where you're so being so, your life is, you're in a cult, okay? That's a cult. Run away. But you'd expect to find people in a congregation or in the church, people who are supporting you and encouraging you and pointing you to Christ so that you can eat in your own gates. And know that when you're eating in your own gates, you're as much before the Lord, in the sight of the Lord, as you are when you're at church, as it were. Church is not where you meet the Lord. You know the Lord wherever you are. And you see the importance of doing what is right in His eyes. But just as you look at Him, you come to realize that He too is looking at you. That the eye of the Lord is on His people. And there are people who encourage us to remember that, to live to a certain standard. Verse 25 and 28, do right in the eyes of the Lord, at the temple or at home, both and always, because there is a higher throne. There is a higher throne. I think our time is more than up. One God to devote ourselves to without all these other things. Just get them out. If it's cluttering up, if it's not God, if it's not right, just get it out of your life. If you're talking to people and they've got stuff in their life, just tell them to just get it out of their lives. Let them fill their hearts and fill their lives with Christ, because in knowing Christ, there is joy. There is joy. And it's not coming under the control of people and pastors and priests and all this stuff. It's coming to a personal relationship with God, who you know, who knows you too. And He places people in your life to encourage and support you in your faith. Let's sing 1116.